wrong thing and then have somebody's lawyer call me in the morning saying, my client was recorded against his will. Okay, we talked about medical ecology on Monday, and today we're going to talk a little bit about epidemiology. This is my favorite epidemiology cartoon. I don't know why I get such a kick out of this, but what I do. And you know, here are two of just the clueless children that are going to come out there and say, oh, yippee, can I get a shot too? So, epidemiology is not a subfield of medical anthropology. Lest you think that it is, because we're going to be talking about it today. As a matter of fact, there are many people for whom the two sciences seem absolutely impossible to reconcile. Epidemiologists have one way to justify their claims to knowledge about events of sickness and healing. They have their own way of achieving knowledge, their own way of verifying this new knowledge about sickness and health. And anthropologists have another, and one which was quite different. Among practitioners of both disciplines, both epidemiology and anthropology, as well as among their audiences, the two are sometimes regarded as pretty tangential to one another, if not entirely antithetical. There are people who, when you ask them to think about epidemiology and think about anthropology, would feel as if we're talking about two opposite ends of the spectrum here. Epidemiology is seen, first of all, as a completely objective science. It's seen as an objective science that focuses on associations that are very clearly specified. It uses variables that are very precisely defined. And the way it looks at those associations is through things like measurement and counting and statistical analysis. So one definition of epidemiology might be the scientific assessment of clearly specified associations among precisely defined variables through measurement and counting and statistical analysis. Anthropologists have accused epidemiologists of being totally immersed in their own particular scientific bias. And my favorite quote made by an anthropologist about an epidemiologist is that epidemiology practices rigor to the point of rigor mortis. Anthropology, by contrast, is clearly, if we didn't have epidemiology up here, it would be a rare person that would substitute anthropology right over there. Anthropology is thought of as a subjective discipline, and that is not necessarily a pejorative sort of thing. It's thought of as subjective. It's thought of as devoted to understanding the inner worlds of other people. And it does so by means of very close, very empathetic encounters. So the two disciplines seem to share very little. Granted, these are somewhat stereotypic notions or definitions, or narrow definitions of the two, but I think that they do not appear on the surface to have very much in common. Historically, though, anthropologists and epidemiologists have worked together for a very long period of time, and there has been increasingly a call for more anthropology to find its way into epidemiological studies, and the reverse as well, for more anthropologists to avail themselves of things that are thought of as epidemiological methodology. Epidemiology is rooted in the observation that disease does not occur randomly, but in pattern sorts of ways. I think that a medical anthropologist would say just exactly the same thing, looking for patterns of beliefs and behaviors, or even patterns behind beliefs and behaviors, is something that anthropologists always do. So it isn't so much that we are polar opposites, as that we sort of go at getting at the truth in very different directions. Epidemiologists are often after universal laws. What they will try to do is eliminate local particularities to see what's global. Anthropologists, on the other hand, focus on the uniqueness of local settings, focus on the particularities. And sometimes they do this so that they can see what this tells us about larger things. But certainly eliminating uniqueness or eliminating local particularities is not something that an anthropologist would build into her or his research. So in thinking about a way for us to talk about epidemiology, that would be sort of a less dry comparison of anthropologists do this, epidemiologists not just this. This would be good for anthropologists to do in barcom epidemiology. This would be good for epidemiology and barcom anthropology. I began to think about some of the similarities and differences between the two sciences, and I started to think about the concept of risk. Because risk is something that epidemiologists talk about all the time, relative risk, absolute risk, all manner of risk. And lots of people talk about risk. Risk is a very colloquial part of the way we talk about things that have to do with health and illness. But oftentimes, when different people are talking about risk, they're talking about it from vastly different perspectives. Much like when the Christian missionaries found that the Hmong had a tremendous belief in the soul. The soul was a big part of Hmong cosmology, and the soul and saving the soul is a big part of Christian ideology as well. Missionaries seized on this because they thought that it was something that could be translated across these cultures, something that was the same. But when Hmong talk about the soul, they are not talking about what Christian missionaries are talking about. And when epidemiologists talk about risk, they're not really talking about the same thing that the lay individual is talking about. So that risk is a construct that can take on a different meaning, depending on whether the language being used to talk about risk is the language of epidemiology, which is one way we can think about risk, or the language of clinical medicine, which is a different language of risk, or whether we're talking about the language of the lay individual. Each of these three groups of people has a relationship with risk, defines risk in a particular way. So these three languages of risk can be used, can be manipulated in the way any kind of language can be, to either affirm or to challenge many sorts of things, to affirm or to challenge existing relationships of power. Oftentimes power and risk come together. To affirm or to challenge issues of control, sometimes controlling behavior, controlling access to resources, center around risk. Or even to express very deeply held feelings of vulnerability or responsibility. So risk is a very, very rich kind of concept, and I thought that it was something that we might want to take a look at, not just for today in terms of epidemiology, but in terms of the readings that we have been doing and will be doing. For most epidemiologists, risk exists as a statistical construct. It's a product of analyzing aggregate data in a particular way. Yeah, Liz.
Is this idea of risk tied in at all to probability?
Yeah.
Probability of certain variables playing out in particular?
I think that risk is tied to probability tremendously in epidemiology, and a lot, but in a more liquid way in clinical medicine. And a lot within the lay individual in terms of perceived susceptibility. So I think that susceptibility is every bit as malleable and as changeable as risk is. And I think that probabilities differ right along with, they co-vary with the idea of risk throughout these sorts of things, I think. And you'll see in the example I'm going to give that probability does come up as well. And I'm going to ask you to take a little test at the end, and we'll see what you think about probability also. So starting with epidemiologists, they construct risk in a way that seems very solid to them. They take the data and they analyze it in a particular way. What clinicians can then do is take the language of epidemiology, the information provided them by epidemiology, and express their own clinical agenda through using epidemiological information. And different healthcare providers will have different sorts of agendas. Obstetricians, for example, can argue that lowering the risk of some complication is a very good justification for some form of technical intervention in birth or some form of clinical intervention in the birthing process. And groups like the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the American Medical Association and the Canadian Medical Association use risk to legitimate their opposition to home births and to midwifery, for example. That this is the level at which they speak about birthing processes. Conversely, those who challenge medical controls also can employ the vocabulary of risk. Midwives then turn around and claim that they're much less interventionist less technological mode of delivery reduces risk to both mother and child. So the concept of risk and things that can be cited are available in all of these different languages. Supporters of home birth have also details of problems that are caused by doctors, caused by being in hospitals, that would never have occurred at home when nature would have taken its course and nobody would have been intervening in this particular way. Epidemiologists speak the language of risk very dispassionately. And it's clinical medicine, it's doctors and it's lay individuals who add a more political and more emotional layer to their language of risk. And if you read things about risk, you'll find that the language of epidemiology into the language of clinical medicine, whether it's doctors or nurses, into the lay language becomes more passionate and less dry as people go ahead to use these kinds of numbers. When we think about health and illness, we don't only think about organisms or pathogenesis or whether we go to a doctor and someone else goes to a shaman. We think about risk and we're taught to think about risk. That's sort of built into a lot of ideas about illness. Sometimes we decide whether or not something could be something depending on whether or not we feel at risk for it. And different people assess their own risk in a very different sorts of way. Sometimes the ways in which different levels of medical culture miss each other have to do with the different ways that people define or accept or reject the idea of risk. And since epidemiologists are sort of in the business of telling us about risk, and they do it in a very sort of dispassionate way, it seems as if risk is something that should be a very objective sort of thing. When you see people begin to live the experience of risk or risky behavior, you can see that it becomes something that's much more subjective. So if you think about smoking or drinking or driving a car or having sex or getting tan or traveling by airplane or what have you, you think about, or you are asked to think about risk in terms of so many of the things that we do in the course of a day. So given that that's so, I think that it's a cultural idea that's very relevant for us when we're looking at illness in a cultural sense. And I was thinking about it even in reading the Fatiman. There are lots of articles that we've already read in the course pack and more to come, most especially the Verghese article about AIDS. When we start talking about sexuality and reproductive rights and death and dying, we'll also be using the idea of risk. A lot of what we read about in Spirit Catches You has to do with risk and the way all the different players involved differently assessed what was risky and what people were at risk for. The way the doctors thought about what was being risked by not giving Leah her medication was something very, very different than what her parents thought she was at risk for. What she was at risk for at base was tremendously different between the family and the medical establishment. And which behaviors were risky were entirely different. The doctors thought that it was risky to not give this child the medication, and the family saw for a fact that it was very risky to give her this medication, because I think they said she became a different child when we gave her the medication. She wasn't the same person. That's a very terrifying sort of thing. Look at how the doctor assessed what was the worst possible risk for this child. It was clearly riskier to let her stay living with her family and not get her medications right than to remove her from her parents as a two-year-old and give her to strangers just so she would be given her epilepsy medicine. That's an entirely different conceptualization of what is risky. What's riskier, taking a two-year-old away from her parents or not giving her epilepsy medication? And clearly, different players involved in this were assessing risk in an entirely different sort of way. And if you were to read something epidemiological about what happens to kids with grand mal seizures if you don't give them their epilepsy meds, none of this would be in there. It would be approached in a different sort of way. So I think it's an interesting thing to think about, especially as we get into the healer portion of things, because risk is something that becomes very explicit when medical personnel is talking about stuff. So I thought that this would be an interesting thing to pursue a little bit, and we'll probably do it more after the break as well. And we can segue right from medical ecology into epidemiology and risk and not even have to leave our friends, the Inuit. That's how relevant this is to Monday. Because two medical anthropologists, Canadian medical anthropologists, examining childbirth and risk among the Inuit, did a very interesting study and talk a little bit about these different languages of risk and how anthropology and epidemiology kind of articulate together in this. These folks were living in a place called the Keewatin. The Keewatin is an area of the Arctic on the western coast of Hudson Bay in Canada. And they provide a very good example of the cultural construction of risk and how this can sometimes bump into the other languages of risk, the language used by clinical medicine and the language used by epidemiology. There are about 4,000 Inuit who live in seven communities in the Keewatin. We're okay anymore because that's all I have, which is good. Each of these communities, each of these seven Inuit communities in the Keewatin, taken together 4,000 people, has a small health center called a nursing station. And these nursing stations are staffed by anywhere from one to four nurses, depending on the community size, and they're staffed all the time. At these nursing centers, routine prenatal care is provided to all pregnant women by the nurses, and then a visiting physician will come by, will rotate around all of these various nursing stations a couple of times during the course of their pregnancy. Not a whole lot, so mostly they were managed by the nurses that staffed this place. The nursing stations are run by the government, and it was official policy at the time of this study that all births should occur in hospital. That was the way it was supposed to go. And so about 2 or 3 weeks before their due date, women were sent to the hospitals in cities like Winnipeg. So at 2 or 3 weeks before their due date, so they would get there in time, they were separated from their families, forced to leave their younger children at home, their older children home if they had any, and sent to the cities to await birth so they could give birth in the hospitals. Up until the late 70s, most nursing stations had at least one nurse midwife. And the policy at that time was that low-risk women, however they defined low-risk at this time in this place, low-risk women were delivered by nurse midwives at the nursing station. And it was only high-risk women that were shipped out of the Keewatin into city hospitals. However, in the early 80s, there was a policy change, and the mandate came down that all women were to be evacuated from the Keewatin to hospitals for delivery. However, more babies were still born at the nursing station than anyone expected, mostly because when women went into labor prematurely, they had to be delivered there. But women purposefully arrived at the nursing station already in full labor. They stayed at home as long as they could stand it, knowing that there wouldn't be time to airlift them out to get into the hospital. So despite this government policy, women did try and manipulate it a little bit by just saying, well, gosh, you know, I didn't really know I was in labor until here I am, and now it's too late to get me out, so you better deliver me here. And so that happened. But after a while, you know, people got wise to that, and when folks came in for their checkup and they were about three weeks away from the due date, would say, now, you know, we don't want you just waiting too long and going into labor, so we have to deliver you here. So they got busted after a couple of years of doing that. Women were extremely upset with this change in policy that said, no matter how your pregnancy is going or who you are, you cannot deliver at a nursing station. You have to be airlifted to the hospital. But there wasn't much that they could do about it. There were traditional Inuit midwives who still lived in the community, but they were very old, and they had not delivered babies in many years. They began to cede control to the nurses because the nurses did a good job, and it was done in a very similar way to the way midwives did. No new indigenous midwives were trained, and so when things escalated and births weren't really being done in a way that was a good substitute for a midwife, they were stuck. There weren't folks to deliver them locally. Not only that, but you can see how these power relations develop. The whole family got medical care through these nursing stations. It wasn't just obstetrical care. It was sort of like a family practice type place. So women knew that if they were labeled non-compliant, if they were, you know, put up a stink about where they delivered their children, this might have a negative impact on healthcare for their whole family. Their kids, other kids are being treated there, their parents, their husbands, their siblings. And so it was very difficult for women to refuse because it wasn't just her own delivery that she was talking about. They were really afraid that they might compromise care for their whole family, and women were unwilling to risk doing that. So that was another piece of the risk that got factored in there. Women complained, but they were generally compliant and got airlifted out. As regulations about mandating births in hospitals got stricter and stricter, there was more and more local opposition. There was a point after which, when more and more technological intervention was being mandated, that women started to be very upset, until finally a team of investigators was assembled to go in and see what in the world was going on with these pregnant women in the Keewatin. And that's how these anthropologists got involved, because it was a research team that had a lot of different folks on it. There were epidemiologists too, but it was a lovely way to combine epidemiological perspectives and anthropological perspectives in one study, which is why I'm telling you about it. It was questions of risk that were at the center of this debate. That's what all of this focused around. That's what everybody used to talk about this particular issue, which is why I chose this study to take a look at. Much of the work of the project was committed to the measurement and to the evaluation of risk. Risk to the mother, risk to the baby, risk to the family, risk to the community, of evacuation. That was what was at the core of this study. But the anthropologists involved were also interested in risk as a concept, risk as a value, not just as a quantifiable, measurable thing. The epidemiologists were going in there and saying, well, look, we have to see how much risk there really is here. And the anthropologist said, yeah, but how do you define risk and risky to whom? Okay, this is the Arctic. It's very cold. It's vast. Travel is a problem. Communities are very scattered and isolated. Transport of patients, of doctors, of medication, of blood samples, of medical records are all done by plane, and flights are few and expensive, and the weather can sometimes close off communities for days at a time. So at the beginning of airlifting women out, it was not a very easy thing to do. Getting those women out of there to deliver them in hospitals was no mean feat. The Arctic has not changed very much since the 70s, but technology has changed tremendously. As the 70s became the 80s, landing strips got upgraded, planes were upgraded, there were better aircraft, there were pressurized aircraft, which made it safer to transport women in labor. So you didn't have to be delivered at the nursing station just because you were in labor and couldn't go in an unpressurized little plane to Winnipeg. You could go in pressurized aircraft. So all of these technological advances had an impact on obstetrical policymaking. You might think, what in the world does technology on an airstrip have to do with obstetrics? But it really had tremendous effects that were direct, in that pregnant women could be evacuated more easily, but also indirect, because perceptions of just how inaccessible these Inuit communities were changed tremendously. It became logistically much more easy to get in there, get these women, and get them to hospitals. And as it became easier to do this, it became ideologically much more difficult for administrators to allow birth to continue in the communities. It wasn't that, oh, well, it's so risky and it's so arduous to get in there and get them out, we might as well at least let some proportion deliver there. So you can see how these things are all work together. I will spare you the long version of the place of the Canadian government and Canadian childbirth. Suffice it to say that statistics about infant mortality are a very symbolic marker about countries. And the powers that be in countries are very aware of this. You always see comparisons of infant and perinatal mortality used as indicators of just how advanced a country or a community is. We use these sorts of statistics as ways to talk about how good things are in different places. There was a tremendous gap between the rates in the north and south of Canada. And the government stepped in and mandated all this stuff about birthing in hospitals. And the rates of infant and perinatal mortality improved. And that became proof of the government's wisdom in making these decisions about intervention for birthing. However, one of the major reasons that perinatal mortality was high where it was high had absolutely nothing to do with childbirth, although the government was able to use statistics to their advantage. It had to do with the fact that changes in the migration patterns of caribou resulted in starvation among many groups, and babies and postpartum women were the ones who died because they were the most at risk. They were the ones who were the most tenuous to begin with. And they suffered the most from various things that had to do with malnutrition. Changes in the migration pattern of caribou resulted in starvation, but the statistics showed that babies and newborns and mothers were the ones who were most at risk of dying where they birthed at home. So these statistics were able to be used to the government's advantage. In the Kiwan, the Inuit gave up their nomadic lifestyle. They settled into coastal communities, and sanitation and nutrition were very poor. Infectious disease was a problem among this group, and people became dependent on government services, and the government response to a tuberculosis epidemic was to send people south to sanatoriums, where they often died. This was the history of these particular people, the people that were now being sent south to deliver their babies in hospital. The communities really suffered. They suffered tremendous disruption, demoralization, and families were separated. The government feels like they saved the Inuit from starvation and extinction and tuberculosis. But the evacuation of women to the south to give birth is still very much colored by family members' remembrance of what happens is the government comes in and takes you and sends you south in the 70s with TB, in the 80s or 90s to have a baby, and you never come back. And so people who were trying to put these things in place completely missed the history of these people, their relationship to what happens if the government says, you're sick, here's what we're going to do to take care of you. We're coming in to get you, and we're sending you south, and you never see these folks again, and families are torn apart. So this was very salient to the Inuit women, and it was completely ignored by policymakers. As childbirth technology grew, childbirth outside of a hospital began to look less and less acceptable, as it does in other places, not just in the Arctic, because the gap between what could be done in the hospital and what could be done in these nursing stations was getting wider and wider and wider. The more newly trained nurses and obstetricians became reliant on the things they learned in their training, which were technological things, the more technology got substituted for skills. So the nurses and doctors that got assigned to these nursing stations, although in a biomedical sense they were maybe better educated because they had much more understanding of technology and monitors and scopes and all that kind of stuff than the people who came before them, were actually, in a sense, sort of doubly unskilled because they didn't have the machinery to use at these nursing stations, and that was the only way they knew how to manage birth was by using these machines, and they didn't have any idea what to do without the machines. So in a sense, these more highly trained folks who were at these nursing stations were much less well suited to be there and take care of people than people 10 or 20 years before them. They didn't have any experience with untechnological birth, and they had no confidence they could manage childbirth without technology, and they kind of didn't believe that most people could manage childbirth without technology. So these public meetings took place, and the health professionals defended their position, and the epidemiologists came and gave their position. And the Inuit women came to talk about their feelings about being evacuated to a hospital to give birth. And the dialogue that went on at these meetings centered around risk. And the dialogue was in all three languages of risk. The epidemiologists would say stuff, and the clinicians would say stuff, and then the women in the community would say stuff, too. And the women would complain about being evacuated. The clinicians would listen, and their answer would be to talk about mortality rates and the risk of birthing in the nursing stations and those sorts of things. And one woman said that she could not remember a single mother or baby dying in the previous 16 years. And I meant to bring a book to be able to read you this big long quote, so I wouldn't have to type it down here. But the transcript of these meetings was really quite interesting because you can recognize, even without the little notation to the left that tells you the status of the person who's talking, whether it's a physician or one of the women or someone from the public health department. You can see just by their language of risk who they are and what they're talking about. The doctors would use epidemiological language in an attempt to convey this very complex information to a lay audience. You can hear him trying to sort of translate what the epidemiologist told him to try and make these poor folks understand how risky it was to have babies, and to try and persuade these women that it really was in their own best interest to be evacuated out and go someplace else to give birth. And when the women protest, doctors say things like, look, this risk exists, whether you choose to believe it or not. It just is. This is the truth. The truth is you're putting yourself at risk. And you can say, no, I'm not, but you're just as great a risk whether you believe it or not. She is not impressed by his numbers, by his language of risk, because statistical death does not hold as much sway for her as her own experience, which is of no deaths. So the doctors and the epidemiologists come in and say, well, you know, for every 1,000 women who gave birth this way, these sorts of things happen. And she would say, I've lived here all my life, as have my mother and grandmother. I've never seen anybody die in childbirth. I don't care what happens in your hospital in Winnipeg. I'm here, and we're talking about here. So he gets all flustered and goes on to say, well, you know, I've seen 7 women die horrible deaths. None of them were Inuit. None of them were from Keewatin. None of them was giving birth at home. They were all from this hospital where he was. But he wanted her to believe that this was a risky situation. He said, look, I have all this clinical experience, and my clinical experience is women die in childbirth. That's what happens sometimes. And the local people turn things around in their own way, in a very elegant sort of way. They challenge the doctor's philosophy. They challenge the doctor's ethics. And there was an Inuit language of risk that came through very clearly. And it was rooted in Inuit culture and Inuit experience, and it didn't derive from some generalized, non-professional view of the world. Many of the people at the meeting were elders who were traditional Inuit midwives. The community felt they should be there at the meeting. And their view of childbirth, as you might anticipate, was that it was a naturally safe process. The clinician's construction of childbirth was that it was inherently dangerous. You're in this dangerous situation, and what you need to do is everything you can do not to let the danger happen. The midwife saw it as an essentially safe sort of thing, and if you sort of let things go along as they should go along, chances are things are going to be okay. So in some rare instance, something will go wrong, according to the midwives. According to the clinicians, in some rare instance, something might go right if you didn't have machines, but do you want to risk it when you're delivering your baby? Inuit assumptions about the general riskiness of human existence was linked to their own history, as it would have to be. Where else could they formulate their ideas about what is risk? One woman said, and I do have this quote, "We live in an isolated community where we put ourselves at risk for any number of life-threatening situations. We live here. This is our choice to live here. And if anybody feels that they can't live with that risk, then they probably move elsewhere. The possibility of losing a child simply because of the place that we live, if that happens, that's a sobering thought, and it'd be a terrible thing to happen. But it's still our choice to live here." So you've heard the cultural history of the Inuit just a little bit, and talking about the caribou sort of stuff and tuberculosis and those sorts of things. People for thousands of years survived in a harsh environment. This is their experience of the way they live their lives. Through their own competence, through their own skills, through whatever way they've adapted to their environment, they manage. We talked on Monday about the Inuit and dog sleds and 5,000 calories and not eating livers of polar bears. These are folks who know how to get through their days. Their understanding of the natural and what is natural is something that they bring with them to the childbirth experience. One of the elders, who was a midwife, I think, said, "The Inuit people do not believe that having a child, being pregnant, birthing, is a disease. It's a part of life, it's a normal function of a human being. And in the sense that it's not a disease, they don't think you need to be in a hospital." So risk isn't denied so much as accepted in some sense, as part of the reality of life in the Kiwan. One person asked, can you guarantee me my life tomorrow? I live here. There's always risk in my life every day. You wouldn't live if you didn't live with risks. So you can see that their response to people telling them that they were at risk for something was rooted in their own experience and health beliefs, and birthing has to do with the same sort of thing. For the physician, risk in childbirth is a constant and frightening element of his clinical life. His job is to manage the risk that's inherent in childbirth. The bigger question becomes, not only in this example, but in other things that we'll read and talk about, who has the power to define risk and to insist that their view should be the one to prevail over others? And this is the sort of thing we think about daily when we're thinking about drinking and driving or practicing safer sex or who should be allowed to come in contact with whom. So the debate sort of moves away from the question how much risk is acceptable to you to what kind of a society do you want? And the Inuit clearly wanted a society that wasn't mandated by this other kind of definition of risk. And the encroachment of the government on this particular part of Native life was a very interesting example of these different languages of risk. We have evolved a very interesting relationship with risk. There's been some very interesting debate lately, I don't know if you've been following it in the paper, about warning labels on products. There's been a lot in the paper about it in the past few months. Not labels on cigarettes or alcohol, that's interesting too. But this is using the language of risk to which we resonate greatly in our health culture for some entirely different cultural agenda. Some of these warnings seem absolutely ridiculous until you understand why they're there. Let me share some of my favorites with you. And all you have to do is go to Toys R Us and you can find these too. There is a Batman costume on sale at Toys R Us. This is what the label on the package says, and I quote, "Parent, please exercise caution for play only." This is a Batman costume. For play as opposed to what? As opposed to, you know, a disguise to stick up the 7-Eleven, I guess. Okay. "For play only. Mask and chest plate are not protective. Cape does not enable user to fly." Now, as a parent, I'm really glad, you know, this warning is there, because otherwise, I might let my kids go right up to that window. You know, you want to go for a fly hunt? Okay, but do you have we want to be safe now. But on that cape and out the window you go. Also at Toys R Us, same aisle even, Toys R Us, there's a plastic toy hard hat that tells you not to use it for safety at a construction site. Can you just see the construction worker who's going to, there it is, his helmet, you know, and his kid's helmet. Which one shall I wear? Oh, I think I'll take this pretty pink one. It was pink. Okay. McDonald's, you may recall, was told a few years back to pay a customer $2.7 million because the coffee that she drank was so hot that she scalded herself. $2.7 million. So McDonald's coffee cups now have a warning on them that reads, "Caution, contents hot." At Starbucks, if you look, they are classier. At Starbucks, their cups say, "Caution, the beverage you are about to enjoy is extremely hot." That shows you McDonald's, Starbucks. In North Carolina, a teenager was crushed to death. This is not supposed to be funny, but it's funny. A teenager was crushed to death when a soft drink vending machine fell over on him. Okay? The upshot of this is that the court ruled that soda machines now have to have a warning on them. I don't know if this is just in North Carolina or not. The warning says that they are big and bulky and you should not like rock and shake them violently if you lose your 50 cents because if they fall on you, they will crush you. This is the level that we are dealing with now. Okay. Also at Toys R Us, not to single them out, it could be at Kmart just as well, but I just happen to be at Toys R Us, there's a $5 plastic sled. It is a 4-foot-long piece of red plastic with a 4-foot-long label stuck to the back of this. The label is as big as the sled. Here's some of what it says on this sled. "Wear a helmet at all times when sledding. Allow no more than 3 riders at a time. Do not ride while lying on stomach, while lying on back, or when standing. Avoid trees." Avoid trees, it says on this. Honest to goodness. "Avoid trees, stumps, rocks, branches, or any man-made object." We eliminate everything there. "Do not use near streets, near roadways, near driveways, or on sidewalks. this product does not have brakes. It's a piece of brakes. This product does not have brakes. Do not pull this sled using any motorized or non-motorized vehicle. How many vehicles does that leave? Motorized and non-motorized, they're out, okay? If I were to buy this, I would say to my child, here's a piece of red plastic. Put it on the carpet, sit there, and watch television. With this thing, okay. There is a stepladder which I owned, which I took out last night to change a light bulb, and because I was collecting these, this is the label that's on my stepladder. It has 21 points of warning, each with a little bullet next to it, some of which warn me about getting electrocuted, about not placing the ladder in front of an unlocked door, not balancing it tilted on a staircase, and my favorite one, do not climb up on this ladder if you are not in good physical condition. I mean, you want, okay, am I buffing up to change this light bulb? Tell me I can climb on a stepladder. That's how good I am. Okay, I read this ladder, I'm thinking, like, it's like the Three Stooges stepladder. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. Every step had a piece of this until they got to warning 21. Okay, why? Why do we feel the need to tell parents that it is risky for them to believe that if they put a cape on their child will not have the power of flight, so they better not let them jump out the window? Are we a nation of idiots? Yes.
I mean, it's obvious that people did this, and that in order for companies or whatever to protect themselves, because they paid $2.7 million to this idiot who couldn't figure out to blow on the coffee before she drank it.
Exactly.
Exactly. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. We do not see unacceptable risk lurking around every corner. If someone were to come here and read all the warning labels we have on things and then get into their spaceship, on the way home they would say, these people are scared to death. They can't turn around and do anything. Look at these sorts of things. However, it is not about health and well-being, as Marisol said. Yes?
I was just going to say, it's not about being scared. It's about liability.
Exactly. It's about lawsuits. That's what it is about. And it shows how we can tap into cultural ideas and solutions from one realm and apply them elsewhere using the language of risk. Yeah,
the only thing that I have a question on about lawsuits, I mean, that's the first thing that comes up or that we think about. It's about being sued,
mm-hmm.
companies being sued.
Mm-hmm.
But remember that program that you had us watch or you recommended about the healer in the 1700s?
Right.
Just sent off a message. It's about a woman who kept a diary and...
Oh, right, the Laurel Aldridge thing, yes.
Okay.
Not to the class, to the graduate students.
Oh, sorry. Where there was made mention that in that century,
yeah.
and probably the one following it, that there was more litigation in the courts than there is now.
Mm.
You know, people were being sued back and forth for different things. So how does that, knowing that happened, that has happened historically, where there was more lawsuits going on, how does that play into this idea that, well, we give ourselves... I mean, these warnings are up
mm-hmm.
for fear of being sued when there has been more suits that have gone on in the past.
I don't know, except that what I think is that it's discontinuous. I think that maybe there were lawsuits in the past and there were laws in the past, and then things changed, okay? And now we have new laws and we have a new peak. I think there probably was a trough somewhere. I don't think it's continuous such that here's where it was and now we're here. I think it probably looks more like that because the kinds of liability laws we have. There are so many of them that are new. I'm not really sure, although I recommended people watch that show, I myself did not watch that show. Okay, I found this example, which is my favorite, okay, about using the language of risk and tapping into, because, you know, you can't really put something on a stepladder that says, don't be stupid or don't be a negligent parent, you know, that sort of thing, but the language of risk in terms of injury and illness is an acceptable way to be able to warn people. It looks as if it's beneficent, and also it carries a tremendous amount of power. And we can even use this to lie. This is my absolute favorite example. Victor Schwartz is a corporate lawyer whose job is to defend companies against product liability claims. And this was his finest moment. In the early 1980s, teenagers discovered, lo and behold, that they could get high by spraying one of his client's cleaning products into a plastic bag and inhaling the fumes. Fabulous discovery, okay? The label on the can clearly warned that serious injury and death could result from inhaling the product, but this carried very little sway with teenagers looking to get high, as you might imagine. And there were deaths, and there was brain damage, and there was all sorts of horrible stuff. The company said to Mr. Schwartz, "We want to put an even bigger label on the can." And he said, "Don't put a bigger label on the can, because if you put a bigger, scarier label on the can, then teenagers will assume there's even more good stuff in the can now, and they will use it even more. New improved, death spray. That's good. He said, leave it to me. I'm an expert. What do kids worry about more than death and injury? Mr. Schwartz asked his clients. How they look, he said. Here's how we will revise the label. The new label says, and this is a complete and utter lie, warning, inhaling can cause hair loss and facial disfigurement. It does not, but they have not had a liability claim since that label went on the product. And his clients are very happy. And Mr. Schwartz's comment in this article I read was, and that's why I'm paid $370 an hour. Okay? If you know the culture with which you are dealing, you know how to do this. Now, let me give you this. These are 22 leading causes of death per year in the U.S. Okay? They are not in order. I would like you to rank them from 1 to 22, with 1 being the thing that you think is the largest risk, and 22 being the most benign thing on the list. Now, I'll just stand here and sing the Jeopardy theme. And just for fun, I'll collect these and I'll analyze them and I'll let you know what you all said. But you can keep yours when I give you the answers. Okay. staff was not getting results from this. So
okay.
Just to see how close people could get.
Right.
To estimate how many deaths per year. I'll ask for that. Are you talking to your neighbor about the answers to your quiz?
She's not very confident about her answers, and I'm just gonna help her out a little bit.
Michelle, just keep your eyes on your own page. Okay, are we ready or are we not? Are we very far from being ready? We're ready, okay. I have here the actual correctly ordered list, and then just for fun, you can score yourself if you want to, and then I'll collect it and I'll present you with the aggregate data after school.
Right.
That's how long it takes an anthropologist to analyze aggregate data with an N of 40. It takes her a week. Okay. This is the cause of death. And let's see, does that hide the number pretty well? Yes. Okay. Here is the order. Okay? Let's take these one at a time. How many US deaths per year do you think there are from tobacco use, which is number one on this list? Did everybody have number one? Anyone have number one? Was this right. Four of you. Okay. Okay. Anyone want to take a guess how many deaths per year of tobacco use? We're not numbers crunching.
10,000?
200,000? Okay. 419,000 deaths per year. And this, and that does not count secondhand smoke, which is on its own. In its own category. This is just you, the user. Not you, the user, necessarily, but them, the user. Okay, alcohol-related, this garbage category comes second. Yep, Sam.
When they say tobacco use, do they mean cancer caused by tobacco use, or what are they talking about?
Heart disease, too, and they also mean probably emphysema, and also smokeless tobacco, and I don't know, maybe fires, death
no,
they smoking.
Fires or something, or carelessness.
I don't know, they're not defining their stuff very well. Okay. The garbage category of alcohol related, I'm not going to ask you to guess because we don't know what it means, but it's second. Whatever it means, it's a terrible thing, and whatever it means, 108,000 people die of it. Now, this is number one. This is going to be the highest number we have. You can see that there's a vast gap afterwards of anything aside from tobacco use, and that does have to do with the fact that tobacco use has so many different ways to kill you. Motor vehicle accidents are third. How many do you think kill people a year? 90,000, someone said? 80. Well, go drive, but don't smoke. 42,000.
Okay. What is a survey rating?
Ah. This, where I got this from was Consumers Union was trying to assess how well their employees, a random sample of 200 people who work for Consumers Union. Now, if you work for Consumers Union, you are like intimately involved with this 4-foot label on the piece of red plastic, okay? So they asked these folks who are the heads of departments or something like that to do this rank, and this is how close they got to the actual rank order. So you'll see that as we go down. Okay, secondhand smoke, how many people a year?
35,000.
Oh, very close, 40,000. Fourth, and Consumers Union employees thought it was seven. Okay, A's. This is, I believe, this was published in December 96, and they said that they were like probably the previous calendar year, so maybe we're talking 1995 in the U.S. deaths from AIDS.
37.5.
Pretty close. 30,000. So you know that it's going to be less than the number above it. So it's not even, I shouldn't even make you guess because it's already been given away. Okay? So this was, secondhand smoke was underestimated and death from AIDS was overestimated. Drunk driving, 17,000. Radon from lung cancer. I was astounded by this. 13,600 people. Radon is that inert gas that you don't know anything about, but it's in your basement. Okay. And the Consumers Union folks were surprised about this too, because they put it down at 17 out of 22, and it's way up there. Food poisoning, falls in the home, and I had to laugh because they obviously don't have my stepladder. They couldn't fall off that thing. If you read the label first, it's foolproof. Here's drowning, and it's a big number, Liz. That's why it's good that it's there. Fires in the home. X-rays. These by X-rays, they meant things that were ordered by doctors in hospitals to have X-rays. Not like you got zapped by an alien. This is legitimate. You were supposed to have this X-ray. Kills you. Bike accidents. Carbon monoxide poisoning. Here's hunting accidents. Lightning. And we know that there's that one guy from that movie. He got zapped 7 times that one year. I was thinking of him too. Okay. Tornadoes. Bees and wasps. And I am way more afraid of bees and wasps than I am of radon. You know, here's radon killing 13,600 people, and I'm afraid to be stung by a wasp. Skydiving. Skiing is as safe as skydiving in terms of deaths per year. Football. And hang gliding is the least risky here. And look how less risky it is to go hang gliding than what? To go sit in a tornado. Yeah.
But they're really not. I mean, you have to look at statistics, they're not really safer. It's just less people hang gliding and play football, less people skydiving and ski. So.
Okay.
Wait, and isn't it also depending on like the age group that you're, because I think like accidents are the number one killer between people ages, you know, 15 to 24, mm-hmm. but between.
Actually, a wider range than that, because it's not the.
Right.
It's almost everybody.
It's almost everybody until you get sensible and turn 30 or something. Right.
And then in the upper age groups, you know, it's not.
Right. Clearly, risk is not distributed across the population. And it's interesting to look at something like this, to look at this kind of chart, and do something just like this. And what the folks who did this survey found was that if you ask people to describe a chart like this and talk about risk, if we were to talk about the risk of all these sorts of things, people will construct their own very interesting narrative of risk having to do with which of these have something to do with them and which of these do not. And, you know, you can certainly look at that and say, you know, well, who's so stupid as to go hang gliding? And maybe a cigarette smoker saying, you know, of course I'd never be so stupid as to go hang gliding. Maybe there's some sort of a interestingly different in that. When I did some research with lung cancer patients, I'm not sure if I told you all about this or if we just talked about breast cancer in here, but asking lung cancer patients who were smokers to describe for me what they thought caused their lung cancer was quite an interesting experience, because I had patients who had smoked 3 or 4 packs of cigarettes a day for 50 years, describing the onset of their lung cancer this way. I live in a house with very old plumbing. There's copper lining the insides of my pipes. Trace elements have been leaching into my water from the plumbing, and I drink a lot of water because I know it's really healthy to drink a lot of water, and look what happened to me. Not to his non-smoking wife or, you know, 7 non-smoking children, but to him. This was, and this was hardly an anomalous sort of thing, so we do have the ability to manipulate this. Now, what I want to talk about next was this combination of anthropology and epidemiology, and how sometimes injecting culture into epidemiological studies cannot be as wonderful as it seems. And we see this mostly with the construction of risk and risk categories in HIV. But we only have 15 minutes left. I have way more than 15 minutes to say about anthropology and HIV, and it's gorgeous out there. So let us stop now. When we come back, before we do healers and cures, we'll talk about risk and HIV and STDs and that sort of thing. But for now, go forth and enjoy your time, and I will see you.
I know. I think every place will be
important. Yeah. There's a huge amount of national prestige and also funding and that sort of thing that you get by changing your infant mortality ratings. And if it costs more to make your numbers look better, then that's what they will do. Mm-hmm. So I've taken a Stanley Cap report to bring your numbers up it's worth it. It's worth it. If you bump those numbers up, it's worth paying that amount of money. And that one test, it's worth paying those thousands of dollars to do it. And it was very important for the government to look at it, especially after they had this problem, lots and lots of infant deaths from starvation. They really were looking at these backward Indians were making Canada look like a backward country.
That one.
Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, I'll look forward to reading.
Would we have done the same thing for, say, an inner city urban?
I wonder, that's a very good question. I wonder if it'd be harder for them to do, because it's, because what they were dealing with was a traditional sort of folk practice versus modern medicine, as opposed to people who were classified as underprivileged or deprived in some way. It was technology over native practice. It didn't have to do so much with access to scarce resources in a different sort of way. So I don't think that the Canadian government has done the same sorts of things for people who where the issue is poverty so much as technology. Technology was really what was driving it.
But if you look at like really rural, very isolated, non-Native American communities in the deep south or something, where people are still sucking on sassafras and all that kind of thing, why don't they do the same thing? I mean, because it seems to me that there's a lot more than just...
a lot of this is between Canada and the U.S. I mean, the way the U.S. does things and the way Canada does things is quite different.
Yeah.
This is Canadian policy. So maybe if the Canadian was in charge of the rural south, perhaps healthcare would be very different if our government were different. But this was such a complicated decision, and I suspect that rural Canadians also were affected by this. You know, we heard more about the Inuit because it became an anthropological issue. But I suspect that it probably was beyond that. I do have this. I'm really talking about it. Good question, though. I'll email one of the authors in this article.
Because if you look at like Appalachian communities, which are very isolated and backward, I think that something like that, I mean, you know, they need.
You can't really compare what the Canadian government would do with Inuit in the Arctic with what the American government would do with people in Appalachia. It's just we have entirely different approaches to the provision of healthcare services. If you look at infant mortality and perinatal mortality statistics, they serve as kind of a gloss for how advanced a civilization is. It's really interesting if you look at those sorts of statistics. That's what's of all the statistics that they could publish, that's become sort of a translation for that. And that was very important to the Canadian government. They fancied themselves as being modern folks. And when if you look as if you're backward. Interestingly enough, the U.S. doesn't worry about that quite so much. I mean, if you look at our infant mortality statistics, they're abominable compared to most places in Europe. And the U.S. government doesn't particularly care so much about that. They figure we're number one anyhow. We don't have to mess with this. But Canada is really very unhappy about it. It's an interesting statistic that gets used. And because it is, and it's something that you can intervene and manipulate, or so they felt, it's the right category for manipulation. That's one of the, there's all this data that's there already, and they can just change things around. So our numbers are, when the numbers being better didn't have much to do with hospital births, because that's not why these folks were dying to begin with, right? So once that was over and done with, it didn't matter anymore. But they could use the numbers to So is everything done? Everyone signed everything they needed? Okay.
Yep.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, thanks for that.
It was
easy.
I didn't stand up there and talk like I always do. So that's good. So how many folks